Welcome, everyone. The millions of families affected by addiction need support and resources as they work through to support their loved ones. Because every family is different, there is a no one-size-fits-all approach to supporting a family working through the impact of addiction. My guest today, Laura McLaughlin, is a licensed marriage and family therapist who helps families understand their unique needs during recovery. She's here with us today to discuss the work that she does to understand the family dynamics, how she both respects boundaries while encouraging growth, and the ways she helps families find new ways to relate to each other so that each and every member can thrive and live well. Laura, welcome to the show. So grateful to have you with me today.
Oh, so grateful to be here. Thanks a lot, Erica.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, you do so many different things because you're, you know, you have a private practice, you work at a treatment center in Beverly Hills, and, you know, obviously you're so well regarded in this industry and in the world of recovery. But how do you begin to address a family when every family really is so unique?
Well, you're right, Erica. Every family is unique, and I've seen so many different kinds of dynamics coming into treatment centers. And you have to realize when someone comes into treatment, there's always been some damage in the family. So all members of the family are suffering in some way. So that's mm-hmm. why we really think it's important to treat the family as well as the addict. So, and I know you have heard in the recovery world, addiction is a family disease. So when we say that, it means that everybody is affected. And most times these families have been isolated because, addiction, it's like a hush-hush issue a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And people feel shamed, not only the addict, but the family members. So, and everybody's reacting to the addict's behavior, and they get caught up in the behavior of that person. So, and they all come Absolutely. In with different kinds of emotions. So,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm so happy that you addressed that and saying that it is a family disease or family, dysfunction of some kind, because a lot of families that I've seen recently, for some reason, there's always one family member that's kind of like, we don't need therapy. Everything was fine. My child wasn't really, nothing really happened bad. And that may be the case. Maybe that parent doesn't literally remember anything really wrong going on in the house, but I think that child has endured some kind of misunderstanding when they're young, or there's some kind of trauma that has not been addressed, or some kind of disconnect. So
right.
how do you get some families that are a little bit in that state of denial to kind of see that we're not pointing the finger? It's not about blaming, but it's really about understanding and kind of going from that place.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point. That's where a lot of family members start with mm-hmm. addiction, is being in denial. Whether it's simple denial of I don't have a problem, or we don't have a problem, like you mentioned, or kind of rationalizing it. Well, I only drink on days that end in Y, I kind of make a joke because sometimes you have to laugh at it because it's a very serious issue that people just don't want to look at.
Right.
So I think it's really, when I'm working in a family, I really try and respect where they're at emotionally and what they're willing to talk about. I think just, like you said, how do you approach a family who's saying, well, it wasn't really an issue? Well, you bring them into the room and you have them listen to one another. When the addict who's in recovery is ready, mm-hmm. I like to have them stable, so they're not, emotionally dysregulated. Mm-hmm. They have some kind of hope for their recovery so that they can actually either, whether it's listening to a family member who's been affected, or the mm-hmm. family member can actually listen to the addict who is going through them, and they can validate each other. I mean, that's such an important first step, I think, of healing a family. So I don't know about you, but that's really kind of where it starts, is being able to hear what the other person's experience has been. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes they've been quiet for a long time. So
Yeah, and validating is so important, because it's a form of compassion, and it's a form of being open-hearted and open-minded, which, you know, if anybody is resistant or defensive or fearful and all those all those negative words, there's not going to be much growth that's going to come from these sessions. You know, it has to be, to some degree, someone needs to crack open a teeny bit. And so I love that you say that, because I hope anyone that's listening going through this understands to try and be mindful and do their best to listen and to keep their mind open. And, you know, I know that you work a lot with people who are changing their identities. And like you said, that they're a little bit stabilized. I think when you begin to understand your core values and who you are for maybe the first time ever, or maybe you've come back to yourself, either way, don't you think that's really important for people to do that work when they're a little bit more clear on their core values and who they are?
Yes, definitely. I often, a lot of times I'll wait to bring a family member in, especially if it's a young person. I know you work with a lot of young people who are really starting to, you know, get their identities. They may have been doing drugs from the time they were 12, you know, so emotionally they feel about that age. You know, if we're working with parents, say, waiting so that they can own that recovery process for themselves, and then bring the parent in. Because oftentimes the relationships are so toxic, they've been so damaged, that, you know, the child feels very ashamed for what they've done. You know, they've broken the trust of their family. And they feel like they really just don't have any kind of identity outside of that broken system. So I think when they come to us, you know, as you've seen, you know, in your work as well, it becomes a new family for them. So they repattern themselves into the new family of recovery. And, you know, and I don't know about you, Erica, but I think sometimes it's important for us as therapists to provide a neutral ground for any family coming into therapy. I know in my my previous work, and in presently where I'm at working with more parents, and with spouses, sometimes those family members, they don't want to voice their emotions to the addict, and they need that neutral person to talk to in, you know, in a very, you know, most confidential way, because they're not really ready to express some of these more vulnerable, you know, feelings. So their whole life has been directed towards the addict. You know, they often come in with, you know, they've been obsessed about, you know, the addict. You know, are they going to drink? Are they not? They're worried. They have a lot of questions. So it's answering those questions. They may have a lot of anxiety. You know, can I fix them? Is it up to me? How do I manage it? You know, or they're really angry. I mean, they're just fed up. And so they need that to, you know, kind of download that with someone who's not invested in the relationship.
But what you were saying too is, you're right. It's, and that's why every family is different. But because, like you said, there's just an array of emotions that come when people walk into that room for those sessions. But being vulnerable for the first time sometimes is really shocking to, I think, some people, because, like you said, they're all focused on the person recovering or that person's sickness, that they've never really been allowed to kind of be vulnerable themselves. Like I see sometimes clients who watch their parents cry for, like, you know, they haven't never seen one parent cry, or, you know, it's always just, there's always something that comes up that is quite shocking to everybody that's in the room. And it's a beautiful thing. I think that you know, I want everyone to also listen, that is listening, to understand there's so much hope and there is so much room for change and growth as a family system or unit. And I know you've seen that personally, and so have I. So, you know, anybody that is a little discouraged to do these kinds of sessions, I really encourage people to take that leap of faith and allow someone, like you said, like a therapist who's neutral, to help you do that work.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, we've both seen great healing in this area, and there's so much hope. And I've seen relationships flourish, you know, and I know you have too. Basically, I mean, what happens, you throw addiction into the mix and communication stops. because really the natural course of a system, of a family, if we're talking about a family as a system, they want to establish a balance and keep it together. So what happens is they, you know, whether they take on roles, you know, specific roles and ways of communicating that minimize the consequences that are experienced from the use of, you know, drugs or alcohol. Because, you know, they want to divert the attention from the addiction much of the time. So, especially if there's a period of sobriety, it's like, oh, well, he's doing well. So, you know, let's move on.
Right.
That's their, you know, that's their hope or, you know, their denial. But they don't want to face this, you know, the elephant in the room. So,
right.
Because it's too distressing for the family. They want to keep order, or, you know, or homeostasis.
Yeah.
A good word.
Right. The balance. Yeah. And because you brought up communication, I think it's such an important piece to any relationship. So whether that's couples or families, or you communicate with your, you know, colleagues and people you work with, it doesn't matter. I think communication is key in general when anybody is trying to live a healthier life, whether that's in recovery or whether that's just, you know, they really have not been living their best. And I think one of the most important things, a foundation of sorts, when you are changing your life for the better, is to learn how to communicate effectively. Wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that I'm big on communication. I mean, when I work with couples, families, I'm always focusing on communication patterns, because you know, in a healthy family system, you know, individuals are allowed to express their feelings, you know, without fear of ridicule or retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's consistent rules. There's rules about communicating. It's like you don't verbally abuse someone, and often you find that, or you don't withhold communication.
Right.
You don't, you know, communication is locking your door. You know, when you have a child who's addicted, oftentimes they'll stay in their room for a week at a time and not talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So really changing the modes of communication, and a lot of times people need help. They don't know how to communicate. So,
right.
Having
so how do we help?
There,
how do we? Yeah. I was going to ask you, how do we begin?
Yeah,
to,
having
to
someone
help?
To help guide them and kind of notice how they are, how they have been communicating, and what's working and what's not. So
identifying the patterns, kind of having someone help
sure.
you identify the patterns. Uh huh.
Yeah, and I think, and you know, when someone's in early recovery, basically they're trying to identify what they're feeling. You know, it's like.
Right.
Is it anger? Is it? It's very simple sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And so if you don't know what's going on inside of you, you can't express it. So,
yes.
And if you're afraid to, and if you have someone holding that space where you say, "Wait, it's this person's time to express themselves." You know, I have a whole session devoted to family members coming in where they get to talk. And they get to express their reality because many times they haven't. So, and it's very scary for them. And,
yeah.
You know, the addict who's in recovery will have to sit there and listen and actively listen and repeat back to them. You know, many people are familiar with active listening. Say, okay, so I heard you saying this. And it's
mm-hmm.
a very validating experience. I mean, it seems very simple. At first,
yeah.
But it's necessary. I mean, when do you actively listen to people in your life, right?
Right. No, it's been.
So.
I think it's a phenomenal tool, actually, one of the best ones out there. Like you said, especially for people that feel so invalidated for all these years, or so just ignored and so put down, it's really probably quite overwhelming for them to actually. Be the one that is sitting there and the other person is actively listening and repeating back what they said.
Yes, and it gets a little bit bizarre. They sometimes turn to me and go, this is weird. I say, just hold on, you know?
Right,
so
right, exactly.
I said, you know, it may feel odd because it's different, and then they get used to it, you know? And so much, you know, blame is thrown around, you know, coming from that I position. I feel this. And sometimes
right.
it's hard for people, you know, to start that process of coming from that, I feel such and such.
Right.
Yeah.
And so also with communication, though, whether it's family members deciding that they are going to communicate better, I think there has to be a level of meeting of the minds and safety, so that even in a couple, let's say if a couple comes to you, because I know you work with couples also, and a couple comes to you and says, you know, he never listens, or she always walks away and shuts down, or whatever it is that's going on in the dynamic. I'm asking you for people that are listening, maybe that a helpful tip for them is don't, how do they begin to like get on the same page? Like, don't they both have to feel safe enough to communicate? Or if one is communicating in a way that's ineffective, how can they communicate in a way that the other person could hear them?
Well, I think it's always owning what you say. It's taking responsibility for what you're saying. And really, not using words like never or always, because what that does, it holds the person to the past. And for that, they basically can't change. Well, you know, right. You never, I'll have, you know, couples come in and they'll be talking about something that happened 10 years ago that they're still angry about. So,
right. You
know, they're not up to present time. So, what we really, you know, ask is, you know, stay in the present time. Don't bring up past, because people will lob things at each other. Just to kind of get a rise out of someone saying, oh, I won this. There's no winning in communication or, as a couple. So
I love that you say that. Yeah, I'm really happy you brought that up, because I think it is always a competition. I think I have also seen this too with couples and families, that there's always someone waiting to react. Like, there is no, like you said, listening. It's like, how can I react and win this conversation or win this point? And it's not about that. And if that's the angle you're coming from, it's going to be a very, it's going to be a very hard road ahead in terms of becoming healthier.
Yeah. And I think it's, one thing, that we find, we throw the idea of codependence around a lot.
Let's talk about that. What does that mean?
Sure.
So people that are listening.
I always get questions about that. I do many groups on codependence. And the reason you can do many groups about codependence is because it comes out, in many forms. As far as, we gauge our sense of ourselves on what other people are doing. So I like to say, that you're a codependent if you feel guilty if you say no, and you feel resentful if you say yes. So I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's really kind of a telltale sign. So I'll give some examples of codependence, because that might be a better way to understand it. So,
oh, that's a great way, too.
I feel sad or resentful because I spend my whole life giving to this other person, and nobody gives to me. So I hear that a lot from family members. Or I feel angry when my help is not effective. So a lot of times you'll hear someone saying, I find myself saying yes a lot when I mean no. And I do things that I really don't want to be doing, or, I'm doing, we'll have, I call them rehab widows. Like one, a member, it's my little thing.
I like it.
The addict will come, come to treatment, and they'll be sitting there, getting taken care of. And the person left at home, they're like, I've always been doing, more work in this relationship, and I've been doing for the family, and here I am left with three kids, and he's off there getting help all day.
I've heard that many times.
Yes. So you know what that is. And really, you have to, tell the person, this is your process of learning how to take care of yourself, because now we're taking care of your mate, your partner.
Right.
He's here with us. So you go take care of you. And I think that's really, a codependent is putting the focus on someone else. And addiction causes that. I mean, it's a byproduct of it, because
right.
we have to focus on what the other person is doing because they're not dependable. You know,
right.
We don't know if the bills are being paid, right? So we don't know where they are at night.
Right. So, right. There's no consistency. Yeah, there's no consistency with you know, within those behaviors usually.
Right, right. And also, yeah. You know, there's also this switching, like you said, no consistency. We don't get consistent love from an addict as a family
yeah.
member. So a lot of times, you know, when that person is sober, it's like, oh, gosh, I'm feeling good about who I am because I'm liked by you today. So it's kind of that inconsistent love. Like, will they like me today? Are they going to be angry at me today? And children mm-hmm. often suffer from this a lot, you know, when they have like an addicted parent. They say, well, how can I please mom or dad? Why is mom locking herself in her room? And she's telling me to go fix my own dinner. You know, I've had 10-year-olds in group. You know, we used to run family groups, which is a great normalizing environment for people because it's usually the first time that they've heard other families dealing with, you know, the same issues that they're dealing with.
Oh, yeah.
So that can be I encourage anytime a family is feeling alone in addiction, get with other families. Talk with other
Absolutely.
Families going through the same thing. But, you know, I've seen 10-year-olds, well, you know, I just used to hide my dad's tequila bottles. You know, and that's just sad. You know,
yeah.
I would smell my dad's breath when he came home. You know, it's
right.
You know, it creates that hypervigilance in a child, and they can get very anxious.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's so much that comes from all this, and really, you know, understanding I think is the best way. Educating yourself on what anxiety is, what codependency is, how to begin to take care of yourself, how to communicate, how to have boundaries, how to say no. I mean, these are all such really imperative things to understand, to get educated on, and to have, like you said before, somebody that is neutral that I think can help normalize it for you or give you some ways in which you could start moving in those directions, like a therapist, like yourself. I think it's so key because being alone in it's not always the best way. I think it is good to be able to have someone to lean on, someone that's obviously a professional that has worked within this scope for many years. So I always encourage people to talk to someone.
And don't you think, Erica, that a therapist also can give courage to a family, you know, mm-hmm. courage to set boundaries, you know, and that's when we speak about boundaries, we're talking also about limits sometimes is, you know, the family, you know, states what they will and will not support, mm-hmm. you know, what kind of behavior they will and will not support. And they don't support behavior that's destructing and damaging to its members.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it may sound pretty simple, you know, obvious, right? But oftentimes it's not.
Right.
So it's saying, hey, you know, when you use this language with me, it hurts me. Or
right.
when you don't answer my call for 3 hours and I've got to call a number of times, you know, that's disrespectful for me.
Right.
When you say you're going to follow through on something and you don't, it makes me feel very insecure and, you know, and there's little hope. And
right.
it just deteriorates trust in the relationship. That's a big, big thing is trust.
Absolutely. And I feel like sometimes people don't even realize, they don't really realize that they are deteriorating the trust by these behaviors. That's why it's so important to speak up, to speak your truth, to really be in that vulnerable place to say what it is you truly need from someone else. Because I think at the end of the day, we all have to understand that we're allowed to ask for what we need because that is really being a healthy human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And being able to identify what you need, you know, sometimes when someone's off, you know, away for 90 days in treatment, they, you know, the person gets some t- time and space to say, this is what I need. Or the person in treatment says, oh, this is what I need. I mean, I've witnessed separations in my office. And both of them say, wow, we really should have not been married. And we've been unhappy for a long time.
Right.
So, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. There's some many, many good things that come from that, too. Yeah, absolutely. Laura, thank you so much for being with me today. I just want everybody to know where to find you. It's Laura McLaughlin, MFT.com. So it's LauraMCLaughlinMFT.com. Right. Got it?
Yes, it's a little bit long, I know.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for being with me. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you for joining us, and stay well.